do, or look at or touch, as that's enough to get you into deep.
Okay, so I'm here. We have Douglas Rushkoff, who is most recently the author of Life, Inc. Douglas, how are you doing?
Hi, okay. A little crazed, but fine.
A little crazed. Well, first off, the general gist of your book is this, that we are all indentured in this 6th-century relationship with corporations. And, of course, all relationships need work. So, with that in mind, I actually want to go back to the beginning. You write that the wage-labor system that was established in Portugal in 1253 is no different from the one we see when you have day laborers outside a Home Depot parking lot looking for work. But, actually, I want to correct you just a little bit and actually get you to respond. According to a very helpful book called Daily Life in Portugal in the Late Middle Ages, the salary of the rural laborer actually rose between 1253 and 1379. And for a while, the day laborer actually was, you know, this is pre-exploitation by the managerial class.
Yeah.
But the day laborer was doing actually okay. And in fact, the services were in demand. And so I'm just curious what your thoughts are. If the problem really is a scenario in which day laborers or workers in general simply aren't standing up for themselves, like the initial wave of day laborers in Portugal, because that's quite fascinating. They were doing quite well, and they were actually able to live a pretty reasonable life.
At the beginning,
I
mean, although I didn't write about Portugal day laborers, I wrote about the French ones, which was a more extreme case. See, Portugal was actually a port city. So it was a little bit easier to create value and to send it. It was kind of a unique case. Portugal was a little bit more like almost like a Florence or something. But the initial transition from a society where people worked and exchanged value to one where it was illegal for them to do that and they had to work for corporations. It took a different number of years in each place for that to devolve into absolutely exploited laborers, to no one being able to work the land, to people no longer being allowed to do subsistence farming, getting sick. I mean, in France, it was, 50 years and we got the plague. In Portugal, it was 100 years, or so. But where you didn't have absolute monopoly control of industries, where people were still allowed to fish, where people could still farm a little bit, you didn't have the same rapid dependence on big companies for work. You didn't have everyone, in Portugal running to Lisbon to get jobs. It was sort of a slower transition, so it wasn't quite as awful. In answer to your question, you can't stand up. I mean, you can't. If you are a day laborer in an industrial society, the job that you have was developed to make it impossible for you to stand up. It's a low-skill job. It's highly specialized, but very low skill.
Your belief then is that we can't go back to this early golden age of the Portuguese day laborer that I had mentioned at the very beginning here.
Well, I don't think we can ever go back, but we can. We can certainly change our relationship to day labor. We can still. I mean, there are still some things, not that many, but there are some things that are going to be produced better by, assembly lines of workers. That doesn't mean that the assembly lines should be manned by day laborers. Even Henry Ford understood that if his business model was going to succeed, that he needed to pay his workers enough for them to buy a car. The idea of the transient day laborer happened because people who used to work, the peasants who worked the land, now needed to go to the cities. And you wanted them to be as replaceable as possible. You wanted to pay them as little as possible. So
you also factor in branding into this relationship, so to speak. You write, a kid's selection of sneaker brands says more about him than his creative writing assignments do and is approached with greater care. But let me ask you something, Douglas. Do you remember the brand name of the high school sneaker that you wore?
I do.
Really?
Yeah.
What was
it? I wore I wore Keds, and then I wore this JCPenney brand. But by high school, I was in Scarsdale, and everybody else wore Pumas and Adidas. And we just wouldn't spend the money. We couldn't spend the money on it because my parents would spend everything they had to get us into that neighborhood. Yeah. And I was teased actively and relentlessly because I had a fox on my shirt instead of a little alligator.
Yeah. But the writing that you did, the times that you had, surely now, decades later, you remember those times. They matter more to you than the brand name of that sneaker. And not only that, but it seems to me that you had a situation, and I had a similar situation in terms of having hand-me-downs and that kind of thing.
But I went to high school before MTV.
Yeah.
I went to high school before this hyper-branded universe even happened.
But such a statement is a bit of a generalization. Do you think that this applies to everybody?
No.
Every high schooler? Okay.
Well, no, then why do you pull out a single sentence from a book and try to say that my entire argument is based on that?
I'm trying to sort of figure out exactly where you're coming from in terms of how
I'm saying
this
if you go back to the talk to most high school kids about the amount of effort that they put into a paper and how much they thought about it, try to have a deep conversation with them about a paper, and then have a deep conversation with them about which brand of tennis shoe they bought and why. It doesn't mean they're stupid. It means that they have more depth of knowledge and experience and thought into who is Nike, what does Nike mean, what does the brand image mean, than what did Abraham Lincoln do with the railroads in that paper I just wrote.
Even inner city kids? Even inner city kids, you would say? Or kids who have parents who, as you like your situation growing up, don't have the option of putting hundreds of dollars out for a high brand sneaker.
I think the poor, in many cases, the poor actually have more of a relationship to those brands than the wealthy.
I ask this question because in light of other examples that you use in this book, you attend a wealth expo at Jacob Javits.
Right.
And you conclude that a lot of the people who attend this expo were there to essentially improve their circumstances. They were almost Rube-like.
Right. I don't think that the people going to Wealth Expo are spending the $200 or $500 to have a cynical entertainment experience or to laugh at Trump. I don't think they really are getting it as they'll look at this funny, bizarre, cultish situation. I think they are there in earnest. I think they want to make money by going.
But I'm wondering, would it not have been more, I suppose, would your scope have been broadened if you had followed, say, Charles and Sandra, like 2 or 3 years later to see if someone actually got money out of these DVDs that were thrown into the audience? I mean, you know, I didn't actually see in the book any positive results from Wealth Expo, and I'm wondering if you actually were able to determine any over the course of your peregrinations and your inquiries.
I was more interested in the Wealth Expo as a phenomenon. I was more interested in, I mean, and it's true, we should follow the secret. It is possible that the people who are using the secret are developing a spiritual path through which humanity is going to be saved. It is possible. You know, and if it's not, I think that the probability of it is so low that I don't want to dedicate my life to pursuing that. I think it is such a blatant scam that it doesn't even deserve that sort of long-term sociological study. But anyone who wants to go do that, I welcome them to do it. I was more interested in the fact that even after the real estate crisis, now it is my belief, and you don't have to buy this either, it is my belief that it has been revealed that many banks and many Americans made some mistakes in the real estate industry and in mortgage backing. We could argue this one, but I think that it has been almost proven that there's a crisis of foreclosures and mortgage-backed loans and those kinds of things have turned out not to work the way they were planned to. And I think that's almost accepted. The Wealth Expo that I went to, which was happening after the mortgage crisis, was trying to teach people how to take advantage of other people going into foreclosure. Most of the people I spoke to at the Wealth Expo were people who were in foreclosure. So they were looking at how to try to make money off people who were about to go through the same thing that they did. And at an event that had fairly accepted charlatans, Jack Canfield and Donald Trump and, you know, get rich quick real estate DVD schemes that you see on TV at night, you know, flip that house, that they shared the stage with Alan Greenspan was fascinating to me, because I feel like he understands that this really is the real estate market. But now, can look at, and maybe it will work. Maybe you're right. You know, maybe that the way to get through it is to scam, that it is a scam. Let's join Amway. Let's join Mary Kay. Let's create pyramid schemes and MLMs. Let's flip this house. Let's build something out of nothing. And maybe there's another, you know, few laps in that horse yet. Go for it.
Well,
if you believe it.
It seems
to me. I think the opportunity, rather, is to consider whether there are Americans who might choose to create value with their work, to make something, to provide a good or service to someone, and that there's still time to build an economy on the exchange of value between people rather than rather than pyramid schemes.
But this pyramid scheme, The Secret, the Wealth Expo, whatever, Amway, people are still going to these things. They're flocking to these things. This may, in fact, stand against your people-based economic solution that you're suggesting here and in the end of your book.
I don't understand. So you're saying that lots of people in a country end up killing other people, right? So that stands against the logic that people might have fun not killing each other.
Maybe you could.
What are you saying?
Well, what I'm asking here is that perhaps you could explain why people continue to flock to things like The Secret, while the 600 years that you document in this book demonstrate that corporations are essentially in control and
The Secret is corporate. What do you think The Secret is? You think The Secret is a bottom-up, homespun, let's hold hands and reclaim America movement? No. What The Secret is a set of instructions for people to basically assume the same posture as corporations, to create wealth by thinking it. It's not, I think the very reason why people do flock to a pyramid scheme supporting philosophy like The Secret is because they have internalized the logic of corporatism, because they think that the idea of actually doing something for someone, of actually lifting, is obsolete.
So you go after Maslow in this. Do you think Maslow's a pyramid scheme?
No, I don't go after Maslow. What I'm concerned about is that the way we've interpreted Maslow's hierarchy of needs is that it ends in self-actualization. So it ends in the idea that the self, the individual, is what matters. And it dovetails really nicely with sort of the personal salvation of American-style Protestantism. And the individuality, the celebration of individuality of a consumer society. And I think he did have it wrong. That there is no, that finally the spirituality movement and psychology movement even that was launched by Maslow and this hierarchy of needs towards self-actualization ended up incorrectly focused on self-interest and self-aggrandizement over connections with other people.
One pivotal question before you...
I can even talk.
But, okay. Self-actualization. I mean, is this not necessary in some sense? Do you not have to have confidence of the self in order for you to go out and help people or assist people and raise their confidence and help them achieve self-actualization? I think that, you know, what I'm wondering is
It's a great, great means to an end. It's a great means to an end. If if ego gratification is going to help you do good things, if knowing you're going to get your name on the side of a hospital for giving them money, if that's going to help you do it, then that's fine.
I think you're misunderstanding my question. If I want to help other people, and I don't want to tell anybody about it, the first thing I want to do is make sure that I am in a good position to help other people,
right.
That I am essentially self-actualized, so that I can be confident enough so that I can be there in a strong position for someone who is in a weaker position, and therefore...
How do you plan to become self-actualized?
Just confidence. Just confidence and being able...
How will you get it?
Internal strength.
Sitting alone, you'll develop confidence? Or do you think maybe you'll develop confidence by interacting with other people?
Sometimes. It all depends. I mean, then you're dealing with introverts and extroverts. What I'm talking about is getting to a place that is strong so that you can, in fact, help other people. This is what's typically known.
But then self-actualization is not the very top of the pyramid then. You're saying you're getting self-actualized in order to do something else. I agree.
Okay.
I put self-actualization at the bottom of the pyramid. Get there. Develop an ego. Find out who you are and then move up the pyramid. And that'd be great.
Well, you develop a sense of self-actualization so you have no ego, so you can actually help other people.
Right.
I mean, in fact, near the end of the book, you go to a donor's site, and this is actually rather surprising for me because typically we accept good deeds that are done without announcing them, without advertising them. And here you are in this book writing about your anonymous comic book donation when in fact you're now, it's no longer anonymous. You're now it becomes about the ego. So I this is why I kind of...
Oh, not at all. I was writing about that example not to try to demonstrate to the world that if I give a box of old comics to a school that I'm a good person. What I was trying to do was show that the website that's supposed to help you donate keeps the transaction so anonymous that you can't actually find out where to give the comics. It was based in money. This is a website that lets you give money to things that you want to give money to. But by keeping the person or institution to whom you're giving the money anonymous, you can't actually give them value. So there was an opportunity to give a school in my neighborhood the money to buy comic books. It turned out, rather than involving Chairman Bernanke in that transaction, I had a shelf filled with comic books. DC Comics gives me a box of comic books every month. I wanted to bring those directly, but because the mechanism was so tilted towards money, because the only charity it understood was cash, it would not enable that transaction.
So you had to do it
through. And for you, as supposedly as a journalist, to try to repackage that example as me claiming some moral superiority for being a donor is not only illegitimate, but it's either just inaccurate and you misread the book, or which I don't believe, or it's almost like a Stephen Colbert, like I'm not interacting with a real person. I challenge you. Why would you want to bring that up as supposedly an example of me showing off?
A journalist, actually, I will tell you, a journalist friend of mine did read your book, cited that particular example. We argued about it over email, and so I'm going ahead and clarifying this with you.
Yeah.
Therefore, it's not necessarily, it's an objective question trying to clarify something, and it's not so much a ransacking.
It's so clear. Why would I bring that up? If you read it, you know why I brought it up. It wasn't to say I'm a good person donating money. It was part of a section saying that I think instead of giving money, which is a very long distance tool, we should get involved directly with people in our neighborhoods and actually do stuff. And that the mechanisms that we've set up are largely biased towards long distance giving. But I don't think I'm that good a person. I don't think I give what I should.
Just let's just clarify here. You couldn't just walk in with a box of comic books to the school and just say, here you go. Give it to the kids.
I ended up doing that.
Yeah.
But not to that school.
Okay.
I could not find the librarian who was asking for comics.
Did you go to, then you go to the principal's office, then you go to a teacher, then you go ahead and talk to someone.
Well,
there's gotta be somebody.
It said it was in Westchester School District. So I started calling around, but there's like hundreds of schools in the Westchester School District. I called maybe 15 or 20 different people to try to find out. And then I just went to the one that's walking distance, actually. and just brought my first box and said, do you want comics? And she said, sure.
Got it. Let's switch tacks here because there's a lot in the book. You criticized the WTO, taking particularly issue with Ricardo's theory of comparative advantage. You suggest that comparative advantage is obsolete in present corporate conditions, that most of those on the other side of the trade are debtor nations and the like. I'm wondering, though, considering, say, Paul Samuelson's idea of the best lawyer and the best secretary, whether it's really the scope of comparative advantage that you're quibbling with. Whether you believe that if comparative advantage was applied to, say, individuals or small businesses, that it would actually have an economical application.
It would. It'd be great.
Okay.
It'd be great. So it's like New York City. In a true and balanced economy, New York City is going to have a challenge, right? Because we don't really make that much. We help people borrow money, but debt is becoming less valuable as a product. But, so people, you know, in Woodstock or Saugerties or somewhere are going to be way better at growing food. And New York City people might be better at, I don't know, psychoanalysis or something else. So, yeah, I believe absolutely in comparative advantage that way. But it's been used, we use the theory of comparative advantage to justify the offshoring of manufacturing jobs and other things without creating a new skill set for the nation that's lost all the jobs. And we're not even really talking about trade between nations. We're talking about corporations that kind of straddle nations just using different labor forces. So it's not fair. I mean, I'm not saying Ricardo's wrong. I'm saying it's not fair to use him in that way. Like, I don't think it's fair to use Adam Smith to describe abstract corporate interaction as opposed to the sort of more on-the-ground economies he was writing about.
Or the Nash Equilibrium, for that matter,
right,
which you mentioned later in the book. So I'm curious then, because you rail against Nash and game theory, but I should point out that the Nash Equilibrium was designed to have very specific conditions in place in order to be applicable. I mean, that's not why he won the Nobel. He won the Nobel for economics, not for behavior.
Right.
And so what do you think will encourage people to actually use these comparative advantage and game theory ideas in a way that is more reasonable and more applicable so that perhaps everybody, worker and managerial class, wins? So to speak. The ultimate win-win solution.
Yeah. I mean, his rules actually applied better in Cold War strategy than they did economic. I mean, they did.
Yeah.
Mad, I mean, you're not supposed to say this, it's politically incorrect, but Mad did work. You know, and they were making the same calculations on their side than we were on ours. And it got us there. We're talking about sort of game theory.
Yeah.
I mean, game theory works in negotiation, but you know, the thing that I was everyone criticizes Rand Corporation and Nash for was the presumption of self-interest underlying all human decisions, and you know, these poor secretaries that wouldn't make self-interested choices when confronted with the prisoner's dilemma. And all that means is that human beings don't necessarily behave as economic actors, and that's a good thing. I mean, but it's a kind of obsolete and oversimplified leftist critique to say, oh, the market assumes that everyone's going to act in a self-interested way, therefore the market is wrong. Because we all know now that everyone from, you know, anyone who's read Hayek or done Santa Fe Institute work, anyone who's a modern economist understands that people's financial behaviors are not dictated rationally. So I'm not sure what the place is for that work in economics.
You seem to be objecting primarily to this Venn diagram theoretical approach to circumstances and situations that require far more almost abstruse levels of thinking. But I guess the question is why economic theory seems to matter more than essentially this people-oriented approach that you advocate? Why because, this is valued more?
Because
of corporate power? It has to be less than...
No, because we have adopted certain metrics through which we gauge the health of our society. Ones like GNP, things that have numbers, because otherwise it's all subjective. What are you going to talk about? Oh, people are living more meaningful lives? What's the meaningful life metric? You know, but you can't. But GNP is a metric we understand. Of course, the guy who came up with GNP, who was that, a Hoover guy, I think? After he came up with it, he was like, yeah, but please don't use it for everything. This is a temporary metric. It's not to be used. But we still use it to measure the health of our society, whereas, you know, if we both get cancer today, GNP goes up.
Yeah.
So it's not a good number.
But then again, if we're talking about metrics and we're talking about way of life, this we go from the objective data to the subjective impression. And so this is where we get into dicey territory. What makes you happy and what makes me happy are totally different things.
Right. Which is why we can't have big corporations or big bureaucracies dictating what's happiness and what's not.
Yeah.
If you do it more on a local level, not everything, but the things you can achieve locally, if you do locally, then you can go be the weirdo that you want and I can be the weirdo I want.
You suggest that cultural values of the late 19th century had led people to adopt a viewpoint of the home as its own fiefdom, and that the self-made men were needed to be entirely self-sufficient.
Right.
1894, Godey's Lady's book suggested that a home was a little bulwark against the outside world. Therefore, you have this inevitable rise of suburbia. But I should point out that last year, the United States pointed out that most of the human population was, in fact, living within cities. And I also should bring up James Howard Kunstler and his argument that the suburban way of life is not sustainable. Surely these respective developments suggest that the tide is possibly turning. And not only that, but also there is this issue of like, well, not everybody wants to mortgage their way into oblivion.
Right.
So what of all these many bags of tricks? How do we corral all these issues here?
I read a piece by someone suggesting that they, meaning either government or some big corporations, were thinking about tearing down some towns and suburbs that don't work, like going to Michigan.
Yeah.
It was really interesting. And then letting nature grow over it.
Yeah.
That the plan, that sort of FDR's plan for managed suburbs that cater to the needs of the nuclear family and keep people apart and force them to use cars and promote production, that they've become so economically inefficient as to be unsustainable. The trick is, if we end up with all these people moving to cities with these long, complex supply chains, I get a little worried too.
Yeah.
I mean, what happens then? Do you basically have farm and then cities? I mean, maybe you do. And you just sort of bring stuff in because we've got enough people now on the planet and we can't spread them out.
Right? Yeah, sure.
So,
well, even a block away from where we're sitting, they are now making portions of the streets pedestrian only. In fact, one block away from here. I mean, it started from Times Square and it's going all the way up to
right.
Central Park.
And I don't know, I'll tell you, I haven't thought about it long enough. I still don't know how to feel about it. Because it's like, first I think, great, less cars, people walking city, it's all beautiful. And then I read pieces that say, oh, but rents are going to go up to this thing and it's only going to be, you know, Benetton and Starbucks and there won't be any local commerce. It's going to be another 57th Street.
Yeah.
How am I supposed to feel? I mean, I can't afford to live in New York, much less Manhattan, for that matter. And sometimes it feels to me like Manhattan's becoming this wealthy dome, the Bloomberg Dome. I mean, you don't live in Manhattan.
I do live in Manhattan.
Oh, you do?
Yeah.
When did you get in? How?
Well, we have a good rent. That's just all I'm going to say. We found it. I mean, you know, one has to find what is left in order to live here. So,
I didn't have the skills. It was really hard. It just seemed... But it feels like the longer I stay out, the more impenetrable the bubble gets, you know, that every space and thing, that even in the crash, you still can't get in.
Rents, however, are starting to drop a little bit in Washington Heights and in the Upper West Side a little bit, I've been noticing. So maybe there is a self-correcting impulse here. I don't know. I
mean, it could be. But it is interesting that I mean, this originally I came to the city because it was... When I came to the city, it was still at the tail end of white flight from the city.
Yeah.
And then I left the city as whites were going back into the city. So I've been going... Not because I'm intentionally countercultural, but because it's just economically unsustainable for me to go live in the wealthy place, at least and write what I want to write. But it fills me with hope that people are abandoning the highly isolated, alienated style of suburban living that we've become accustomed to and trying to do other things. Even sort of homesteading on the suburban frontier, where you see suburbs trying to become more like towns.
Yeah. But to go to Birkdale Village, North Carolina, which you bring up, and the new urbanism gone awry, there's one thing I wanted to ask you about this. Okay, yes, in this North Carolina place, you have big box stores and you have parking lots. But I'm wondering if it would have been a more effective example to use, say, Park Slope or the Marina District in San Francisco, which both adopt new urbanism in a manner that runs against space limitations and also it has problems of its own. But I'm curious about whether, you know, as you point out, you write that these master plan faux villages would stand no chance at all of endearing themselves to people who weren't already, and by design, disconnected and alienated from the places where they live.
Right.
But for some people, a Starbucks is a place of community. And so...
And for them it is. Yeah. And I'll tell you, there were genuinely sweet and wonderful things happening between people at that Starbucks. You know, these were people who, they're not stupid people. These were the college graduate people and thinking people who understand that it's a faux reality, but also think it's better than the many other faux realities they could have chosen from. And that there is a Starbucks, there is a place to go, there's some sense of camaraderie. I mean, it was the real estate person who said, oh, don't worry, when they open that other one over there, everyone's going to move. So they're not loyal to the place they're living, but they are loyal to the other people that they're living with.
But it may very well be real to them. I mean, Starbucks is real to them, just as, for example... You have another example when you bring up Walter Benjamin of the person who goes to Disneyland and gets, say, the Mickey Mouse watch that is also available in the Disney store.
Right. Well, what's the difference?
Yeah. What is the difference?
I'm asking what's the difference. I don't really know. I mean, we're supposed to say that the one that you buy at the Disney store isn't as real because it didn't come from Disneyland. But they both came from the same factory in China anyway.
Yeah.
Just shipped to different depots.
But maybe there are extenuating circumstances here. Maybe they were with someone they loved and the watch was there. Maybe they were at Disneyland and that became a watch attached to that particular place. I mean, we don't know. I guess the point I'm trying to make here and the question I'm trying to get from you is, at what point do we... I mean, and it's becoming increasingly more difficult with things like augmented reality. At what point... Is nothing real? I mean, you know, a big loaded question that can go down all sorts of philosophical tangents. But nevertheless, if everything's going to be faux that fulfills these criteria that you're specifying, I'm wondering if it's entirely. I mean, you have to have something that's real in order to live, in order to feel happy, in order
to... And then this quest for realness becomes just another market. You know, okay, so now we've got South Street Seaport, which is a real mall as opposed to a fake mall. Or you can go on a real vacation. And then you can look in the travel magazines for one that's, this is a real. This is a genuine Indian from the Andes who's going to walk us through a real. You know, when you run out of real, or you just trample it. But that's why I think real is not about these are the external trappings of real. But what you can, all a neighborhood can do is... promote or discourage real interactions between people. And that goes back to Maslow and all that. If the self and your perception and what you've surrounded yourself with is your world, then that's that's a consumption-based or a consumer-based way of experiencing satisfaction and reality. If it's your relationships to other people and how you interact with them, then it's something else entirely. And what I've felt and observed is that many different kinds of neighborhoods and products tend to promote this disconnection of people from one another rather than true connection. I mean, I find it hard to say too many bad things about a brand that gives teens something to talk about with each other. You know, and that's why I had this real, 10-year-long debate with Douglas Atkin, the cult branding guy.
Yeah.
And he's like, at least it's a thing. At least when I'm driving my Mini and there's another Mini, we honk and we wave. I mean, we're waving over the fact that we both belong to the same brand tribe, right? But it's a beginning, right? Or is it? Or is it the end? You know, and that's, it's hard to know whether these things actually bring us closer. And if it's the end point of our shared values, the culmination of our shared values, then it's a problem. If it's the beginning of a real conversation and effort towards building an oil-free world, then it's a good thing.
So, Douglas, you and I are at Disneyland. We see a Mickey Mouse watch that we both get excited over, and this leads us into a philosophical discourse that actually changes the world. Therefore, the Mickey Mouse watch isn't so bad, is it?
Right.
Right.
Then it's fine. The only question is, different things over which we can connect have different biases, right? So if we connect over this piece of land in our neighborhood that really should be producing agricultural bounty but isn't because there's all this crap in it, if we connect over that, we are more likely to discuss something that creates value for us than if we bond over a particular brand of tennis shoe.
Yeah.
That's all.
But,
you know, connection is still valuable, and there's still a chance.
The Archimedes principle, Douglas, gradual displacement from the bathtub. I don't know if, I think you may be applying too much importance to the location of a conversation. I mean, sometimes there's this, maybe it doesn't matter. I mean, I guess what I'm asking
is
why go ahead and rail against something that is faux when one, we've established that it's real for some people.
Right.
Two, the actual consumer or branding.
The reason why, and I got to it at the end of that chapter, is because there's no creation of value by anybody in this town. This town is completely, absolutely, and 100% dependent on the chain stores that you work at. It's really just mall employees who live at the mall.
You mean to tell me that you didn't find a single starving artist in a garret in this town?
No. No.
I may have to go and check this out for myself. But
go. But the town itself produces nothing.
Well, what do you define as nothing in this case? Just nothing but chain stores?
It creates no value. There's no production of any good or service.
Okay.
And that's the trick. I mean, real estate, I guess, is a service because you could buy stuff in that. You could buy. But the people who work there, no one is able to create value in a way or have a job in a way that's not directly tied to a giant national brand.
Ah, but if someone works at Banana Republic,
right,
and they may be an artist, that's what they really want to do, or they may have some grand urban agricultural theory that they want to promulgate, that they're just using the money from Banana Republic to save up to launch their great master plan, maybe there is some kind of value on a sort of associative level. So
sure.
I mean, it's like,
there is, even if I want to go, give blowjobs to guys at the Hilton, during the day in order to get a room there where I can, make electronic art. Yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah.
But I guess what you have to do.
But
I'm not saying you can't work for corporations. I'm saying that this is not a real town because it doesn't actually produce anything. It's like the ultimate bedroom community.
it directly may not produce anything, right. But what about the indirect value?
As a trading post.
Yeah, exactly. As you're taking money, you're saving it up so you can actually move out of the town. I mean, that would seem to me a goal. I mean, if this town is as barren and as terrible and as worthless,
but it's made to look like a real place.
Yeah.
And it's convincing, and it serves as a real place.
Were you charmed by
the people
town?
There? At moments, I was. If you look at it just right from the right angle, it feels like. But then when you go around with the architect and he describes the things that they did, all of a sudden you see, oh, these aren't stores. This is one building, and it feels that fake. No, if
the ultimate trompe l'oeil.
Right. If it's the only thing left, I mean, I'd rather live in a fake version of a nice world than a fake version of a not nice world. You know.
Okay, I'm gonna quote one thing that may probably get me into a similar piece of trouble, and
from your friend or from you?
No. As long as it's you. As long as it's me. Oh, yes. So if I give you a question then that is not from me, it's not of value then. That's not what you're saying.
Not if you don't take if you can't take personal responsibility for raising it.
I take all. Okay, you write a viral market that you're proud to have launched a well-known idea, but I'm disturbed by the direction it took. Parentheses, even more than I am by the fact that I'm not the one who got rich off its exploitation.
Yeah.
Aha, aha, aha.
Yeah.
So I'm sure this parenthetical is intended as a joke.
Yes.
But it seems to me that with that parenthetical, you're just as susceptible to that impulse as the rest of us.
I am. I was raised in a corporatist society.
Yeah.
I'm not above this at all. I'm as bad as any of us. I have a mortgage. I mean, although I resisted the temptation that my friends fell under to buy million-dollar homes in Brooklyn, I still live in this society. I'm still driven by the need to be appreciated by others more than to serve others. And I still do, to myself anyway, bitch about the fact, you know, that I came up with ideas like, you know, social currency and viral media and saw other people write books for marketers about these ideas and get really, really rich. And
but with the notion of capital, you're talking about capital not getting rich from this. Wait a second here. Is it about the ideas, the love, or the money? You know? I mean, or is it all three? Well, love or the money. We'll just stick it to a straight dichotomy since we're running out of time.
I mean, my principal reason for doing this is to share ideas that I think are meaningful in a way and framed in a way that I think makes them useful. And I do believe it is a pity, as they would say in Ecclesiastes, that the rewards for coming up with ways to use these same ideas for exploiting people are much greater than the rewards for just sharing these ideas with people who might need them for less nefarious purposes, but such is the world we live in.
Yeah. Well, with that in mind, I should point out.
And I do begrudge that. Yeah.
Then why go with Random House to publish this book?
Exactly. So I can get paid.
So you can
get paid. I could have gotten paid. I mean, the two reasons I did it with Random House is, one, I don't think corporations should go away. I do think big corporations are very good for certain things. Microchips, cell phones, mass-produced goods, shipping things big, long distances. It's much, much more energy efficient to have Random House print a whole bunch of copies of a book at once and stick them in a warehouse than to have me use one of those sort of Amazon print-on-demand services. The amount of energy that goes into making one book at a time is extreme. Also, I felt the need with this book, unlike some of my others, which I have self-published or published for free or used nonprofit institutes to do it, I wanted this book to enter into the conversation. People who work at the New York Times, a big corporation, don't really recognize the existence of a book unless it has the imprimatur of another corporate brand on it.
Yeah.
They see a Random House book. They don't see an Institute of Douglas Rushkoff book. It doesn't exist to them. It's not on the map. And I want to make this argument to all the great Naomi Klein, Naomi Chomsky people, you know, Noam Chomsky people out there. But I also wanted to enter into the conversation of the people perpetuating these mythologies. And the only way to get there was was through the brand.
But if your ideas are so amazing, shouldn't Random House not even matter? I mean, should your ideas just stand on their own and be recognized by all? And
we don't. If we lived in a society where ideas really traveled around completely freely based on their merits, then sure. Then you should be able to stand on a street corner and tell one person, and it should naturally spread by word of mouth. But that's not the way it works. What spreads better by word of mouth is the 300,000 people hired by Procter & Gamble to talk about Bounty and Mr. Clean Magic Eraser.
It occurs to me that you're talking with me because you're trying to promote this particular book.
I am.
And you're not necessarily interested in me as a human being, this people-based economy that you're advocating.
I was basing you as a person until you started to be so mean.
Mean?
And mean, and then I got less interested. But then when you became less mean, I became more interested.
Oh, but then if I'm mean, I'm just being my journalistic self here.
So you're putting on a hat? You have to
be
mean?
No, I'm not. Well, no, I have to go ahead and, if you're going to prevent ideas...
Yeah.
Then they need to be challenged, they need to be discussed, and this helps as we get into the civil disagreement territory.
Well,
and it helps everybody understand
role.
Your ideas and then that kind of thing.
Well, they need to be challenged. You know, they definitely need to be challenged, but challenged in the most genuine way.
You're getting Bernaysian here, sir.
No, I think they need to be challenged in the most genuine way. In other words, sometimes I felt I was getting your honest reaction, and sometimes I felt you were playing devil's advocate. And it's interesting, it's kind of what I want to... Colbert does it in a way that... Because I'm going to go on that show, and I'm a little scared, but he does it in a way where we all know he's playing a character. And I just hate when I'm doing an interview and they say, well, let me play devil's advocate for a minute. And I'm like, no, you don't have to play devil's advocate. Just tell me your genuine, true reservations. And so we have a conversation on the exactly the level that you're at with it rather than the level that you presume people to be at. But, no, I mean, for the first, I mean, it's gone a little interview crazy now, but for the first 30 or 40 interviews I've done, and most of them, I actually do interact with people as people. But this has been one of the worst because we're shouting over this ridiculous thing in this room. It's so hard to interact with you as a person in this setting. But for most of them, yeah, they've been deeply. I mean, and part of the reason I don't market my books well is because I do fall into relationship with the people I'm talking with rather than selling my book. You look at the good ones. The good ones at doing that, even Naomi Klein is much, much better at marketing her books than I am. She'll say, well, as I say in my book, you know, as I say in the chapter on Israel, and well, the important thing about this book, or when I was thinking, they're really good at bringing it back to the product that they're selling. My problem is I am... more obsessed with selling the idea than selling the book. And I've been really successful at selling ideas and less successful at selling books.
Well, I think we'll leave it at that and let the listener decide if you have sold the idea in the book. But Douglas, it was a pleasure chatting with you. Thanks so much.